This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. In the past few weeks, we have shared a few conversations about the Moccasin Bend National Archaeological District here in Chattanooga. For nearly four decades, Sally Robinson has played a role in revitalizing the downtown and riverfront development, including three terms on the Chattanooga City Council and the long road to Moccasin Bend as it is today. Forever Moccasin Bend is the fundraising effort led by National Park Partners, starting with opening the gateway that will add park and new visitor amenities at the district's gateway site. I spoke with Sally and with Tricia Mims, Executive Director of National Park Partners. Sally, Tricia, thanks for joining us.
We're glad to be here. Thanks for having us this day.
Thank you.
Set the scene for us about Moccasin Bend and your connection to it.
Well, the interesting thing about Moccasin Bend is it's right across the Tennessee River from downtown Chattanooga. This is a national park. It's in an urban setting, which is unusual. It means it's easy to get to, it's accessible, and we are just at the beginning of creating quite a destination for visitors and residents alike to learn about our local history and to experience the outdoors just a few minutes, really, from the heart of our downtown.
And not only experience the outdoors, but experience history. And not only history of the Civil War, but as far back as we can possibly imagine.
Well, you know, that's true. There's such an interesting Bend story. Of course, it's been there for, I guess, millions of years. But the story that is so exciting is that it's an archaeological treasure trove because there were Native Americans that were living there for hundreds of years, and they left behind archaeological artifacts that have come out of the ground, so to speak, and are educating us. Then we had Civil War history there because the ridge that runs down across the bend was where the Union forces encamped. And they were bombarding Lookout Mountain, where the Confederates were during the Civil War. So, yeah, there's a lot of history there. In fact, I've often thought of it as just sort of it's like a time capsule that's just full of history.
Tell us more about your experience with the Bend, how it inspired you early on.
Okay, I'll talk a little bit about what inspired me at Moccasin Bend. In 1982, I was appointed to a citizen task force that the city and county were putting together to make a recommendation to them about 600 acres of property that they jointly held over on Moccasin Bend. And I was appointed as a member of the county delegation. And right away, our group got together and we were funded with a very generous grant from the Lyndhurst Foundation, which has provided such generous and pivotal and visioning leadership and support for our community for a long, long time. And so with the funding and with our team on the field, so to speak, we began meeting right away. We went to Baltimore and to Indianapolis to see what other cities were trying to do that were fortunate enough to have a riverfront or a scenic setting. And so we began to learn some of the best lessons about how city planners and designers and architects are helping cities sort of recreate themselves for a new future.
And share with us your own experience out in the Bend. You've written down some thoughts about that, looking back.
Yeah, we gradually, as we began meeting, we began to understand a couple of things about the whole scope of the Bend and what the potential was there for Chattanooga, how unique it is. We were originally asked to make this recommendation, and I think that there were a lot of people that thought we might recommend that there would be some industrial use because the country was in a recession then, and this would be a way to bring jobs if we could put something there that would build on our industrial base. But somehow it just did not seem to fit because we were aware from the outset that the Bend had a treasure trove of history there, and we would be paving over or tearing up our own story, if you will. So after visiting these other cities, and based upon work that had been done many, many years ago, going back into the 1930s and 40s and 50s, there were so many people that felt it really, really needed to be a park. It really needed to be a national park. So our Marcus and Ben task force made the commitment that we would pursue that and at the same time take a bigger look at our bigger picture based on the lessons we had learned in Indianapolis and Baltimore. And I'll never forget the day that we had been working, 9 months, and meeting. We had so many consultants helping us, so many people from the city and county, professionals, everybody so interested in what we were doing. 9 months, we were still talking about Marcus and Ben, and our visionary leader who was leading our discussion was Rick Montague. And he walked into the room and looked around the table and he said, "Folks, we're on the wrong side of the river." And that was sort of when two stories started being told. And one was, what's going to happen with Marcus and Ben? And that's a cornerstone and a very important piece. But we really need to talk about our downtown and our entire riverfront. So that's another story. That's another conversation.
And then as far as the task force,
yeah,
this just took a lot of conversations, a lot of listening, a lot of coordination. Tell us more about what the task force contributed that led to Moccasin Bend as we know it today.
Right. Well, what we did after we secured the property with a national landmark status, which is kind of a distinguishing designation, it means that it's going to be guarded and kept safe until the final plans come in. I think it's forever. But we have been so blessed and fortunate to have been working with the National Park right along with this whole endeavor. They've been our just locked in step partners all the way through it. And what we did, though, we went out to the Bend one day with an archaeologist, a local archaeologist, just to see the property. I mean, we were tasked with making a recommendation how to use it. Many of us had never even been there. We didn't realize that it's just literally, as I said, across the Tennessee River from downtown Chattanooga. You just go right out Manufacturers Road and out Hom Road, and there you are. So we all went out there, and they took us onto just sort of abandoned, overgrown parcel of land. And he told us, he said, "This is where Hampton Place was." Well, we didn't know what Hampton Place was. He said it was an Indian town in the 1500s. Of course, I'm sure the Indians had another name for it, but it was named Hampton Place at this time. So we looked around and there were holes in the ground everywhere. In fact, we had to be careful not to step in one. He said that those were sort of potholes that looters, quote, were digging up Indian artifacts and pots and keeping them for private collections. And some people keeping them, hopefully, to, when the day came, to put them in a museum. But at any rate, there was a lot of pillaging going on over there. And there was one really big hole that had been dug pretty deep. And the archaeologist sort of eased himself down into this pit. And with his trowel, he began removing charred, dark black charred earth about 6 inches down. And he said, this is what is left of the town. It had to be burned to the ground. And that moment, I described it later as having the strangest feeling come into me that the people who lived there were somehow spiritually present even today, and that they want their stories to be told. I just felt their presence. It was such a moving experience for me. And I later wrote down what I experienced that day and undertook a many years long study of the history of our Native American culture there and the history of the Bend, with always thinking maybe I could tell their story. But I never could. I sort of outlined a plot for what it could have been, but I just, as I expressed it one time, I said I never had the courage to tell the story because it's too important to be fictionalized. It needs to be completely accurate, and that's what we're going to do with the Bend. It's going to be an authentic experience for the people who visit there to learn about the history of really the North American continent. As I said, it's almost like a time capsule filled with history from prehistory through the 10,000 years of continual habitation on the Bend to the Civil War history we share, and then to the uses today, which are sort of living and working on the bend. So it's very much a part of our downtown, and yet it's still very much a wilderness.
How does Hampton Place fit into the history of what we call the contact period and the Spanish explorer De Soto?
In the archaeological record, there are artifacts that have been carefully examined that tell us that the Spanish explorers did come very near Chattanooga, if in fact not onto the bend. We haven't ever uncovered a steel breastplate or a spear, Spanish spear or anything, but nevertheless, the history does seem to indicate that there has been contact, very close contact, with the Spanish explorers. Well, that's called the contact period, and that happened around 1540. Well, what happened after that? The Native Americans did not have any immunity to the diseases that the invaders, these explorers, these Spanish conquistadors brought with them. And it just leashed upon the city and the Southeast, and in fact, the United States after this contact period, so much disease and measles and terrible chickenpox, smallpox, and it almost decimated the entire native population in some places. In fact, it did. And then later, after so much history passed, several hundred years later, as we know, there was a removal of our Native American occupants here to Oklahoma across what's known as the Trail of Tears. And when you go on to Moccasin Bend in your own backyard across the river from your downtown, you can actually walk the Trail of Tears. Part of it crosses the bend, and it's clearly marked by the national park signage. It's a safe, easy walk, and you can experience and see what those people were feeling when they were being forced to leave this homeland, this Chattanooga Valley. So that's another reason the Hampton Place and the Native history is so important. And there's another feature of history there for Civil War buffs. They can go up onto the ridge, end of Stringer's Ridge that comes out onto the bend there, and stand there and look straight up at Lookout Mountain and see where some of the battle was fought during the campaign in Chattanooga. Those, I think they call them ramparts, are still there where the cannons were implanted and where they installed and where they would fire all the way from Moccasin Bend up onto Lookout Mountain. So, you know, it's not just a place to go and look. It's a place to go and walk and experience nature and to learn the real stories. Nothing fictionalized about any of this. This is authentic history, and it's fun.
And Tricia, we hear this again and again and again in our conversations that we have had this month. The experience of nature and encountering many threads of history, including and especially the difficult ones.
Definitely. I mean, there's a lot of, as Sally mentioned, layers of stories, just history going back millennia that are sometimes a little bit, we need to kind of tell those stories that are maybe a little uncomfortable, that yes, there were people who lived here and this was their home and they were forced to relocate to another home against their will. And just how tragic is that? So yes, there are a lot of ways that this piece of land is kind of a reckoning place, right? We need to come to terms with some of maybe the darker chapters of our history, but also really kind of celebrate the fact that these cultures were thriving in this area and how much we all still as Chattanoogans kind of are drawn to these places, as Congressman Womp said last week, where the plains meet the river meets the mountains. It's just such a natural place that humans want to gravitate towards. So I think there's both joy and triumph as well as sort of the more tragic stories of despair all wrapped up in one 800 acre piece of land. It's truly remarkable.
And it's not only about nature and history side by side, but it's also an opportunity because you could be talking about just one of those threads of nature and one of those threads of history, but you have so many threads of nature and so many threads of history all intertwined at this one spot.
Exactly. So no matter how you come to Moccasin Bend, if it's looking for a place to hike or if you want to kind of get to know a little bit more about the indigenous culture, history of the bend, or if you're a Civil War buff, no matter what's bringing you to Moccasin Bend, you're going to learn and be engaged with the full scope of the story. So it's really got something for everyone, but you'll come away maybe with a deeper and richer experience than what you set out to find there.
How will Forever Moccasin Bend deepen and enrichen that experience even further than today?
Well, the first phase of Forever Moccasin Bend is creating this entrance. You know, when you arrive at a national park, you kind of expect to see certain amenities or at least become oriented to the property through sort of a welcome center. So this first phase of opening the gateway is going to provide that welcoming entrance. The next phase of Forever Moccasin Bend, which will come after the firing range is relocated off the bend, is what Sally was describing, access to those Civil War earthworks and new hiking trails up onto Stringer's Ridge. Right now, you can access those through ranger-guided programs, but they're not open to the public year-round yet because of the firing range. So once that's relocated, then this whole new area of Moccasin Bend will be opened up to the public year-round through a new trail system on Stringer's Ridge. And then finally, sometime in the hopefully near future, we'll establish a full-blown visitor center there at the gateway site. Everything we're doing now to open the gateway is sort of the parking, the restrooms, the pavilion, some interpretive displays and walkways, everything but the visitor center. But that's coming later. That will have more detailed exhibits, maybe some photographs of the artifacts that have been found. And really kind of the Forever Moccasin Bend, we're thinking this is a multi-phased campaign. But over time, it's really going to continue to peel back the layers and really engage people deeper and deeper in the Moccasin Bend as the years go by.
And Sally, I've been asking this of everyone in all of our conversations. When we think of a favorite spot or spots out there on the bend, which spots come to your mind?
Well, I have to go back to the day on the bend, the first time I ever went there, when I was standing at that open pit looking down in there, and the archaeologist told us that that was a home. It was where someone had lived. And the reason that hole had been dug there, Ray, was because the Native Americans buried their dead under their homes. And he was, in effect, standing in a grave that had held the treasures that family had buried with that deceased family member, and they had been taken. And I hope they're in a safe place and they'll someday be returned to our wonderful visitor center when it's built and we can see for ourselves their beautiful artwork and the things they created. But I have to say that that was the defining moment for me, that I had been given a wonderful opportunity to be on this task force. We worked 3 years. We had a sunrise date. It was in 1982, and our sunset date was 1985. We had to make the commitment that we were not going to end up publishing a report that would sit on a dusty shelf somewhere and never be enacted. It had to be something that would really turn into a transformative project and an event for our city. And as I said, there's another story, you know, that we can talk about later, but ultimately that effort put forth the Tennessee River Park Master Plan, of which Moccasin Bend is a cornerstone. And this was a 20-year, $750 million plan, which seemed like a lot of money at the time, that would be built out over the year, and it would develop a linear park along the Tennessee River that would be for our residents. We didn't want our city to just turn into a tourist destination. We wanted something that the people who live and work and pay taxes here could enjoy. And so it's been built out now. And just look at what's getting ready to happen over on Moccasin Bend. How many American cities have a 600 or 800 acre national park right in their urban footprint? They're not many. We're very, very unique in that regard. And I think it's going to be a mecca for people visiting our area to want to come there and see it for themselves.
And Tricia, when you hear Sally talking about the bend, which spot or spots come to your mind?
Well, I've been fortunate enough to be on some of the ranger programs that go up on Stringer's Ridge to see those earthworks that really are some of the best preserved cannon ramparts anywhere in the Civil War battlefields. So that's a pretty special spot, and you can really, when you're up there on that southern end of Stringer's Ridge, you can see Lookout Mountain, and you really get a feel for what it must have been like to be a soldier looking at the enemy soldiers just across the river and building up to these battles to come. But then if you just sort of turn 90 degrees, you're looking right across the river to downtown. You're looking at Cameron Harbor. You're seeing the aquarium. You're seeing what Sally described as this really amazing, impressive waterfront redevelopment of bringing people back to the river. I think that was one of the amazing things that came out of that Moccasin Bend Task Force and the Tennessee River Park Plan, was really opening up that riverfront to the community in a way that they had kind of been cut off from for so many years. And now to think about Moccasin Bend as kind of that last piece. Most of that riverfront plan has been developed. Now the last piece is to extend the Riverwalk to Moccasin Bend and really fully interpret this incredible National Archaeological District. It's all very exciting.
And where can people go online for more information about Forever Moccasin Bend?
Well, we have a website called forevermoccasinbend.org, and that tells you all you need to know about the Open the Gateway project and ways to contribute if you want to be a part of it. It's really going to be a lasting legacy that anyone can bring their friends and family back for years to come and say, I had a hand in helping create this incredible national park entrance. And so we're really excited to get the community involved.
All right. Sally, Tricia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can listen to all of our Forever Moccasin Bend conversations online at wutc.org. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. My guest is Devereaux Chivington Stebbins, whose pen name is C.S. Devereaux. She writes historical novels, memoirs, and short stories. This past spring, her short story Old Gem placed second in the fiction category in the Chattanooga Writers Guild Spring Writing Contest. Another short story, Beyond the Breakers, placed first in the creative nonfiction category. This is Devereaux reading an excerpt from Old Gem.
Old Gem. Heat waves shimmered off the sidewalk and hung in the air like a dank cloak in our quiet section of Jacksonville, Florida, that summer of 1953. Our apartment was a repository of stifling stickiness that threatened to leech the very life from us. With my father mostly absent, my mother, who was pregnant with my baby brother, was anxious for the relief of childbirth. Her belly grew larger daily. Bad-tempered and edgy, each day after breakfast she put me out the front door into the lobby of our apartment building, leaving me to my own devices. I was 5. The entry hall was cool with its alabaster floors and tiled walls. A marble staircase led to the second floor, and behind the stairs a water fountain hung on the wall. Never drink from this fountain, Mama said. The water will make you sick. It's the janitor's water fountain, and not meant for whites. There were no kids to play with, so I created an imaginary friend, Doc. I trusted Doc because he was always right. And there was Zoot, a stuffed purple donkey, my baby word for the color of his fuzzy coat, purple. Zoot was so very purple that I thought of him that way long after I learned to say the word properly. The two of them accompanied me everywhere. One day, after playing for hours on the lobby steps, I was thirsty and wanted a cool drink. An old wooden chair stood in a dark corner near the fountain. I moved it closer and was climbing onto it when it tipped over. I fell hard to the floor and banged my knees and elbows. I squeezed my lips together so as not to cry. The sound would alert Mama, and I would be in trouble. Hold on there, little gal. I'll help you. A black man set me on my feet and assisted me in getting a drink. The water had a slightly salty metallic flavor, like the tap water in my apartment, like all Florida water that I had tasted. Thank you. My name is Vita Lynn Haney. What's yours? Nice to meet you. I'm Hezekiah, Hezekiah Red. The boss man, Mr. Park, he called me Old Jim after his dog. So when I'm working here, best you call me Old Jim. Why do you do that? Well, Miss Vita Lynn, seem like that dog is a hard-working good old hunting dog. If and he named me after his dog, Mr. Park said, then maybe I'd be a good hard worker too. I had seen him sweeping, mopping, and doing odd jobs around the building, but we had never spoken, and I was keen with curiosity. You don't look old. Where's your white hair? You're right. I ain't so old. Looky there, your knees ain't hardly colored up no more. I squinted up at him. I could see why Mr. Park called him Jim. Hezekiah Red was a mouthful. If it's all right, I'll call you Old Jim, too, until I get a little bigger. You won't tell Mama about getting me a drink from your water fountain, will you? No, ma'am. Your secret is safe with me.
Our guest, Devereaux Chivington Stebbins, reading from her short story, Old Jem. Before we started talking about the story, I asked Devereaux about a quote on her website. It's from a writer called Jacob Norby, who wrote, "Blessed are the weird people, poets, misfits, writers, mystics, painters, troubadours, but they teach us to see the world through different eyes." And do you think you're weird?
Am I weird? No, I think I am controlling and a perfectionist and absolutely impossible sometimes to deal with.
I think anybody who creates something from nothing is probably going to be controlling at times because it's so close. Difficult because it's difficult work. And it's hard to take criticism, and it's hard sometimes to share the world with other people when you're in the midst of doing something like that.
Well, that's true. It's also hard to separate yourself from something you've created. Everything that I write, there's something of me in all of it. These short stories in particular happen to be about me, but typically I don't write about myself at all, and I'm not comfortable writing about myself. These were a real stretch for me. I wrote them during the lockdown. It was a real introspective period for me, so I thought I'd take advantage of it. These are some things that came out of it. The writing contest just happened to coincide with the new things I was putting out. I thought, well, let's give it a shot and just brace yourself and see what happens.
The story about the black man, Old Jim, I kept thinking, I wonder if this is Devereaux, this little girl. It's a work of fiction, you said.
It is a work of fiction, but there's a lot of me in that. And I did live in Jacksonville, Florida, that point in my life. And I mean, a lot of it is true, but I took bits and pieces from that time period and put them together. What prompted it was, oh gosh, this year, last year, but this year especially, the violence and the police violence against black people and the ongoing prejudice against blacks that, of course, having grown up in the South, has been around my whole life. While we have made great strides in my lifetime, it hasn't been enough. I just remember when I was very small, always questioning, you know, why are there two water fountains? Why are there two restrooms? Why is there a separate entrance? Why do they have to sit behind, you know, in the back of the bus behind this sign? All these things. And my mother, she harbored a lot of those same feelings that other people, other white people did. And so she fed me what she believed to be truth. Often it was misinformation, but that's what she grew up with. My father and his family, on the other hand, were not that way. That was very confusing. I didn't have one story. I had conflicting accounts and conflicting reasons for things, and I decided I liked my father's frame of reference better because I saw people as all one, always did and always will. So it's something that's been really alive for me my whole life. So seeing it, how it has just really come to the forefront this past year in particular, just made me think about those times, and I wanted to just show that it's been around, this isn't new, and it should stop. It needs to stop now.
What was Jacksonville like when you were growing up then?
It was hot. I just remember it being hot. We moved to Birmingham not long after that. I was I was five still. It was right before my sixth birthday. The things that I describe, watching the ladies with their bundles of laundry on their head, with their parasols, their umbrellas to keep the heat off them. I remember things like that. I remember tamale trucks, tamale carts. And I remember that probably because the word was so funny. Mm-hmm. But I was very small. My world was very small, too, because I was alone for most of it. That wasn't an isolated incident. I was alone most of the time. Or I was with my parents. And I was also very young. So at my age, I remember clips of things, but there are parts that really stand out. This was one of them. So I can't tell you very much. Those were just my impressions.
Yeah, I get this sense of the feeling of a kind of small country town.
Well, it probably was then. Much smaller. There's the St. John's River. It runs through what may have been the middle of the city at that time, because I imagine that the city was built around it because of ports.
Part of, for me, what makes the story work is that intense parochialism. What people think or believe outside of this fairly narrowly prescribed culture is irrelevant. And whatever the authority figures within that culture want to do, they can do it. And with impunity, yes. I thought you caught that really well. It's interesting where you left off reading it. It ends with, "It'll be our secret."
Yes.
Kind of pregnant with, really? So what happened then?
Oh, and, you know, well, I didn't mean for it to be like that.
Well, that's what people believe. That's why that man, they didn't even ask him. The sense is that he has no counsel. He is resigned to a reality that is beyond his control, that is so completely unfair and cruel.
Yes, I know.
This man's going to end up in prison probably for the rest of his life.
No, he didn't. There was a janitor. I don't remember his name. We were friendly because he was the only person I had to talk to. Mm. And I did see him with his family when we moved to the new house. But I don't think I was on my way to go live with him. I was just mad at my mother.
Yeah, that's understandable.
I decided to take an adventure. But that little incident in the drugstore, it wasn't quite as dramatic as that, but he did come in. And he said, "What are you doing here? You know, have you been?" Because he hadn't seen me in a long time. The manager, that young guy, took the whole thing the wrong way because we knew each other, didn't ask any questions. It didn't matter when I tried to say, well, I was only 5 years old. So I probably didn't express myself very well either. But he called the police. I guess he must have gotten hold of my father at some point because he arrived soon after. They took him away. And my father took me home. I had a chance to calm down and explain what happened. My mother was able to, you know, she could verify, oh, yeah, there was this guy, the janitor that Devereaux was friendly with. Was that the same one? He said, yes. My father called and went down to the station. And he explained the whole thing and they let him go. But had that not happened, yes, he probably would have gone to prison for the rest of his life for just being kind to a little girl.
Yeah, but in the real world, you're not Shirley Temple, he's not Mr. Bojangles, and
exactly.
You know, he's a black man, and you're a little girl with blonde hair.
Yeah, that's right.
In the South in the 1950s, and that reality comes home, that reality of where you are comes home when you introduce yourself to him, and he introduces himself to you, and then says, "But the boss man calls me Old Jim."
Exactly.
After his dog.
After his dog, yeah.
And you say, oh my God, you capture a world in a sentence.
Right. Well, are the little things like that are what make it fiction, but it was reality. The story is fiction because the janitor in my building probably was not named after the owner's dog.
<Let's>
but that's the sort of thing that could happen. That's the sort of thing that did happen back then. The black help, if you will. They were called whatever the employer wanted to call them, and they just had to accept it.
That's the art of what you do. The alchemy of what you do, that you take a real world and a real world situation and you tell a story within that world that makes the world more real than it would be if you were to just recount facts.
Exactly. Well, that's what writers do.
And you do it really well.
Oh, thank you.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. My guest is Devereaux Chivington Stebbins, whose short story, Beyond the Breakers, won first place in the creative nonfiction category in the Chattanooga Writers Guild's Spring Writing Contest. This is Devereaux reading an excerpt from Beyond the Breakers.
Beyond the Breakers is a coming-of-age story about a summer in my life when I was around 11 years old. It is set in Neptune Beach, Florida, the summer of 1961 at my grandparents' home. On the day I'm writing about, it had stormed all day. It is now late afternoon. Our grandfather, Big Dean, grudgingly agrees to take us out to the beach. Sand stings my legs and the wind tugs at my rubber tire tube as we make our way down the boardwalk steps. The beach is empty. Even the ever-present surfers have declined the ocean's invitation. Waves rush at us in crashing arcs. They pound the sand in angry protest at our invasion of their domain. Reconsidering the wisdom of venturing into the water, I suggest we browse for shells and other treasure the storm washed up. The ocean is too rough, and look, the shallows are full of dirty foam and seaweed. I don't want to get in that. Big Dean shouts a reply. Whipping wind steals his words the instant they leave his mouth. He places himself between me, the wind, and the bellowing surf. To know the ocean is to know life, Margaret. One of the sea's lessons is here in front of you. Sometimes you must wade through the muck to reach the good place beyond the breakers. Follow me. Reluctantly, my siblings and I tuck our towels and bag of sunscreen, pail and shovel, under the boardwalk steps, and clutching our inflatable lifesavers, wade behind him into the cold, storm-wrought sea. We do our best to dodge the dingy mounds of foam. Long strands of seaweed envelop our legs. Random jellyfish stingers brush against us. They sting my calves, then my thighs, and finally my arms as I plunge into deeper water. I teach my little brother how to tackle rough breakers and duck under cresting waves. Next to us, Big Dean drags my sisters in their swim rings over the tops of waves. The salty spray catches them in the face. "Turn away from the wave," I shout. "Hang on tight to your rings." On the backside of thundering surf, the rolling sea is reasonably calm. Big Dean treads water between me and my siblings, the back of his head breaking the tops of passing swells. I bobble beside him, my rubber donut ring around my midsection where the fat lingers on my gangly frame. A strong undertow tugs at my dangling limbs. The boardwalk steps where we stashed our gear is a long way off and moving farther away by the minute. "We should go back." "Relax, we're fine," Big Dean replies. "But the tide is still going out. If we aren't careful, the undertow will pull us out with it." "I said we're fine." Apprehensive, I gaze at the distant shore. Behind me, white water sizzle is accompanied by the crack of a breaker and a sudden slap to the back of my head. A rogue roller flips me upside down too fast for me to close my eyes. Submerged, the surface cacophony is muffled thunder above a ceaseless convolution, close yet far away. I spot my grandfather in the dreary haze. His baggy swimsuit drifts with the ebb and flow of the tide between pasty belly and skinny legs. Next to him, my heedless brother and sisters kick the briny water from the underside of their tubes, legs pumping in slow motion. Strands of seaweed churn about. Tiny grains of sand and particulate float around us in an aimless dance. Seashells and bits of debris, half buried in the ocean floor below, are barely discernible in the moody light. I wriggle and twist to extricate myself from my rubber ring, feeling like a fish caught on a hook. My legs kick empty air topside. My arms flail underwater. The tube refuses to budge from my chubby body. My lungs ache. I flounder, becoming more frightened by the second. Then I see it. In the not-too-distant murkiness, a large, dark fish shape hovers near the surface. It eyeballs us. We are worthy of inspection, and with a swish of its tail, it glides closer.
The second story is about a young girl, and there's something apparently of Devereaux again, but you're older now. You're on the cusp between being a child and being a teenager, which is such a difficult time in your life to essay, isn't it?
It is, and that one is nonfiction because that whole incident was exactly what happened. It took me a long time to write it because very difficult for me to express that point in my life when I let go of childhood. And that singular event, those things that happened on that day, catapulted me into the next stage of life. It was the first time that I had questioned adult authority, and it was the first time I made a judgment call that could have had catastrophic results. As it happened, I did the right thing, and that in itself was significant. And my parents accepted that. Thank God you got all of you out of the water, and he should never have taken you in there on a stormy day like that and out so far with the undertow and, you know, all the things that happened, and you could have drowned and, you know, on and on and on. It was quite an emotional story. I blocked it for a long time, and I started digging it out, and it came little by little. I think I've been working on that for several years before I finally got it all together this spring. One reason that I wanted to write it was because I think it's a story that others can relate to, and if it helps one person to understand themselves better, or it helps a parent to understand their tween a little better and what young teens go through when they've reached a point in their life when so much is happening, besides just the hormone rush, but they begin to mature a little bit and see the world a little bit differently and question authority. Are my parents making the right decision? Usually kids aren't mature enough to make good decisions all the time themselves, but they're at a point where they begin to question that if they haven't already. And that makes it very difficult for both the kids and the parents. Of course, we all know. Anyway, I wanted to put it out there because if it helps one person in some way, then it's worth the effort.
I thought it was interesting, the juxtaposition of those two stories. There's this feeling, first of all, that adults aren't entirely trustworthy.
They aren't.
and a little hostile at times, but that was, you know, you explained that. Your mum's pregnant, it's hot, you know, all of those things that to another adult, they would say, what do you expect? But to a kid.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
To a child, your expectation is equally reasonable that your mum should be somebody you can always go to. She's never mean. She never hits you. She listens to what you have to say. But beyond that is that sense that that guy behind the counter in the drugstore in Old Jim, he doesn't recognize you as having any autonomy at all. He picks you up, puts you on the counter that's too high. He jumps to conclusions and doesn't listen to anything you have to say.
Exactly, yeah.
And the same could be said of your grandfather.
That's right. So, anyway, yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, was that conscious on your part? Was that something that, as you were coming of age, you found, I mean, we all found, I assume everybody does anyway, found the adult world frequently mystifying. You know, a lot of the time, it's really difficult to understand why people do the things they do and say the things they do and affect the attitudes that they have. There's a sense in both those children of a profound sense of independence and of clarity in their perspective of things. I see things pretty clearly. It's you that's having the trouble.
Right. Well, don't kids think that they see things very clearly?
Well, they do, don't they?
They
don't necessarily. They can't necessarily.
And more clearly than we give them credit.
Yeah, they can't explain it, but they're going to give you an unvarnished take on it. They're not going to be like adults who feel they have to explain it. They couldn't if they wanted to.
Right. That's all part of what this is about. The kids' point of view, the mystery of adults not understanding why they are the way they are, because as a small child, you don't understand it, so you don't question it. You just don't like it, you know, sometimes. You don't understand it, you know.
Right.
It makes life difficult on occasion.
Well, you came of age in such a fraught time, especially to be in the South.
Yeah.
You lived through all of the civil rights struggles of the 50s and 60s, didn't you?
Yes. Yes, I did.
And from what you just said, you know, to some degree, within your own household.
Yeah. Yeah. When I think about it now, I'm actually glad that I grew up then, because it gave me such a perspective on the world that fits right in with what's going on now. It makes things a lot more clear, doesn't make them right. It makes me very angry that it's still, you know, still happening, but I don't know. I'm just kind of glad that I did grow up then with all of that, the unrest that was happening then. It was terrible, and I hated it then. Sometimes I wished I had been born sooner or maybe later, but just not then. It seemed like such a terrible time to be alive.
Well, I can only imagine. I can only imagine.
Yeah.
You have all that tumult inside you because you're a teenager, and you're surrounded with chaos. You know, you said, blessed are the weird people. An environment like that, man, it was just too easy to feel weird. What do you do with that when you're a teenager? You know, you don't want to be weird. You want to be like everybody else, you know?
Well, I felt weird too, because I wasn't like everybody else.
No.
That was all I wanted was to be accepted into a group and to be like everyone else. I wanted to wear the clothes that had to have just that label on it, and be from this store, and be just like this, and my hair like this, and do everything that everyone else does. And I didn't do any of that. I wasn't allowed to conform to that extent. And so what I did was I non-conformed to, I went the other extreme. Well, if I can't do this, then I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do it well, and just be a total outcast.
And look where you ended up. You ended up as a writer, and what better place to see the world, what better perspective, you know, than to be seeing everything from the outside. See it so clearly.
That's right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
You've had an interesting life, judging from your bio, lived in several big cities.
Yeah, and I set out to have an interesting life. I didn't want to do mom and apple pie and have the little cottage with the white picket fence and all of that. I wanted to see the world. You touched on one of the things we were going to discuss, was why I write. Mm. And that goes way back. When I was 8 years old, one of my teachers asked me, well, an assignment was to write a composition. It was my first composition, and I got an F. When my father saw not just the grade, but what I had written, I thought I was going to be in for it. But instead, he said, this is fantastic. And for the first time ever, I think he, you know, supported me, and went down to the school and yelled at the teacher and said, this is imaginative, this is creative. And do you realize she's only 8 years old? and she wrote this. It really gave her a piece of his mind, and she changed my grade to a C minus.
That's big of her.
Yeah, I know, C minus. So at least it wasn't failing. But she actually wound up changing my life. I don't know what direction I would have gone if she hadn't done this. But in order to help me make up credit so I didn't get such a low grade, she had a small little library in a corner of her classroom. And she said, for extra credit, every time that there is free class time, you read. You can choose anything you want to read, but you must read. And so I chose books from a collection of biographies that she had. I didn't even know it was called a biography at that time, but they were written for young people about famous people: Martha Washington, Abigail Adams, Booker T. Washington. I read probably most of those books that year. I loved biographies, and I kept reading them and became so interested in other people's lives that I wanted to write one day about other people. Didn't want to write about myself, and I still don't really enjoy it that much, as I said before. I'd rather write about others. So that's why I write historical fiction, and I write memoirs now. And I don't necessarily want to write about famous people. I like writing about average people who've had who've had unaverage lives. But when I first started trying to write, I discovered that I didn't know anything about people, and I'd never been anywhere or done anything. So I realized that I needed to know more of the world if I wanted to write in the way that I liked writing. For many years, every time I sat down to write, it seemed like the only thing I could do was write a nice description of something. It just seemed like I wasn't ready yet. And then several years ago, maybe 10 years ago, maybe more, I don't know, I picked up Pillars of the Earth by Ken Follett. It blew me away. I love his books. Realized then that I had read others and didn't really even pay attention to the author. I had read Eye of the Needle and quite a few of his books. I didn't know I was already such a fan. But when I read Pillars of the Earth, I said, something just clicked in me. And I said, you know what? I think it's time you started writing for yourself. You've developed a love of history. You have been all over the world at this point, and you know an awful lot. And you have a lot that you can put into a story and a lot of perspective. And I think that at that time, I said, now is the time. It's now or never. And that's when I began to write.
Devereaux Chivington Stebbins writes under the pen name C.S. Devereaux. Her most recent novel, Sky People, is set in the Smoky Mountains in the 19th century. It's a mostly true story of a Cherokee Indian family struggling through a time of widespread instability and social change. It's set for publication in the spring. Several of her short stories are on her website, csdevereaux.com. This is Scenic Roots, talking writing on listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.